I always wear my mask and wash my hands after going home.
It's a good tuna, but I think I paid too much.
I am the king of the pink.
Welcome to the Japan What Podcast, episode 144. And I am your host, Matthew, pmbigelow.com. Coming at you from the Tomihisa Cho Studios in Shinjuku, Tokyo, Japan. The armpit of Asia. This is the podcast covering AI markets in Japan, Society 5.0, rising conflict in the Middle East, Japan's alliances with those around the world, and you are part of the conversation today. Thank you for joining us on this fine April 2nd day. When I was still had grandparents that were alive, my grandfather, who was a King's Guard in the Norwegian Army in World War II, but we grew up in Canada. His sense of humor was very Scandinavian. There was no such thing as intonation or punchlines, really, to his jokes. I only remember one day on one April Fool's, which was his birthday, by the way. So happy birthday to Ola Ulvestad, captain in the King's Guard. And this was his joke. He said it to my mother. Margaret, this morning was a man looking in the window. What? Really? Where? April Fool's. And she found it the funniest joke in the world, apparently. I still remember it to this day. That was his April Fool's joke. There is a man in the window. No, there wasn't. It's just me being crazy on April Fool's. What a strange joke. All right, so welcome to the Japan What Podcast. And we had a special interview show last week with Max von Schuler Kobayashi, a author who is trying to explain to Japanese people what's going on with the situation in America right now, because most people just get their imported news. It's like fashion. It's like, I'll just go to H&M. I'll just get what the thing is. And this is the same thing with news. What's the Washington Post say? What's the thing on AP? You open up your Japanese English newspaper and it's mostly copying and pasting from the international wires. Bloomberg says this, blah, blah, blah. So you don't really get much of the dissenting information. And we covered some of that on last week's show. Only one show last week as well. Hopefully we'll get back up to speed and start with the two a week again. But we're going to begin with some new products. And I couldn't really find anything crazy. So I'm going to ask you, is this crazy or is it just the future we deserve?
Is it
crazy?
Or is it
the future we deserve? And I have a huge stack of things to cover today. I may have mentioned it before, but we'll just go a little bit more in depth into it. This is coming to us from JapanForward.com, the English arm of the Sankei Shimbun. Very conservative newspaper in Japan, but I interviewed once the editor-in-chief of the Japan Forward, and I found him to be a very reasonable person, and his English was better than most liberal Japanese people I know, so there is that as well. It's kind of weird. It's like, hey, aren't you supposed to be conservative? Doesn't that mean you just only speak Japanese? It's like, well, no, not at all. Honda revealed its new fuel cell vehicle that can be recharged at home, a convenient option in the transition away from conventional fossil fuel power cars. This Japan Forward seems to be on board with a lot of the Agenda 2030, the SDGs, and all of that. Hold on a second. But Tokyo does have a fleet of hydrogen fuel cell buses. And they work well, they operate well, they seem to be doing good. They don't emit a lot of toxic fumes, although I have heard there are some emissions that could be dangerous. They're not exactly God's angels smothering us with Jesus hugs. That's not the way this technology works. I'm sure it'll introduce into its own bevy of issues that some other generation will have to deal with. But overall, the idea of having disparate or, quote, you know, shoot me in the face if you hate this word, diverse energy sources on our roads I say more the merrier. I think it's just kind of interesting from a consumer standpoint, but also from the fact that, you know, when it comes to energy, maybe we shouldn't be putting all of our eggs in one fossil fuel basket of currencies, the petrodollar, all of that stuff. Honda unveils Japan's first plug-in rechargeable hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. And I'll be taking this and posting it up onto the official website of the Japan What podcast at MatthewPMW.com. MatthewPMBigelow.com, and it'll be up there for your viewing pleasure. And it says on February 28th, so this is not the newest story, but it was recently published. I don't know why they finally got around to it, I guess. On February 28th, Honda unveiled the CRV EFCEV, horrible name, a plug-in hydrogen fuel cell vehicle. The car is set to be released in Japan and North America later this year. Fuel cell vehicles, or FCVs, generate electricity by a chemical reaction between hydrogen and oxygen, powering the motor to propel the vehicle. But a shortage of hydrogen refueling stations has hindered their widespread adoption. Honda is the first Japanese company to offer a plug-in FCV that can be conveniently recharged at home. Honda has announced its strategy to phase out internal combustion engines. Good luck. The company aims for all new vehicles sold worldwide to be electric vehicles or FCVs by 2040. The new CRV model was showcased at the H2 and FC Expo, an exhibition of hydrogen and technologies held at Tokyo Big Sight. That's all we're going to read about it today. But we're also seeing that there's this idea of hydrogen refueling stations, and that also hydrogen vehicle filling station opens at former Tokyo Olympics site. This comes to us from Kyoto News, which is Japan's general news web production internet news factory. It's like a pumping station for news. Published at the end of March, March 27th, and we're recording this on April 2nd. But again, the Japan What podcast is not a breaking news podcast. It's covering trends and analyzing events before the current date and looking into what it might possibly mean in the future. That's one of the points of the podcast. One of Japan's largest hydrogen filling stations for fuel cell vehicles opened Wednesday at the former site of the Tokyo Olympics and Paralympics main athletes' village, the metropolitan government said. Major oil distributor Eneos Corp, which is trying to decarbonize, that's right, an oil distributor really wants to decarbonize, will operate the station and produce hydrogen in line with the Tokyo government plan, with the amount of hydrogen supplied equivalent to that required to operate around 40 fuel cell buses for a day. So that makes sense. You have these fuel cell fleets that roam around Tokyo now. They go back to the Olympic Village for their hydrogen fuel, pump up the batteries, and then they don't have to leave the city or go to some remote location to get their juice, their hydro juice. Hydrogen will also be supplied to a district of Harumi in Chuo Ward, Tokyo, through an underground pipeline. The first time in Japan that gas will be piped into a specific area and added to a residential energy mix, according to the metropolitan government. I've often wondered how this is going to work, because if you've listened to the podcast before, it's like, okay, you have this place where hydrogen is, but you can't just go down to the hydrogen station and fill up a bucket full of hydrogen and pour it all over your refrigerator and expect it to work somehow. You need the infrastructure and the piping to go around that. And it says it's added to a residential energy mix, which is going to be very interesting to see how that rolls out, how that comes through the pipe. Hydrogen will be used to generate electricity via fuel cells located in the former athlete's village that has been converted into residential high-rise apartments. That's probably what they're going to do, right? So the fuel cell is essentially a battery, and if you have the ability to swap out the cells or the batteries, you charge the batteries, and then the buses go out with other batteries. And when the buses are done with those batteries, they go back to the filling station and you swap out the battery that's empty now for a battery that's just been charged, or a fuel cell that's just been quote unquote filled. That's a good idea. That's actually very smart. The electricity will then be used for lighting and elevators in the condominiums and commercial facilities. The move is part of an effort by the metropolitan government to expand the use of hydrogen, as it set the goal to halve greenhouse gas emissions in 2030 compared with the 2000 level. again, all these kind of green 2030, Agenda 2030 goals. Not sure if it's going to work or not, but the idea of having hydrogen, at least reasonable infrastructure where the gas is going into pipes and then delivered to people for them to consume. Now, how do you generate the hydrogen? How do you get the hydrogen? Is the hydrogen pulled out of where and where does it come from? What's the supply chain beyond that? I'm not sure where does the energy come to charge the fuel cell batteries or fill the fuel cell batteries? All of that stuff is kind of a mystery at this point. Is it coal? Are they just using all the energy from coal power plants to make hydrogen? If that's the case, it's like one step in a weird direction where you can just kind of paint something green. We're going to learn a little bit later about how Japan is actually potentially implementing the carbon credit scheme worldwide. And I'm not sure how they're going to get away with this, but it's all a piece of the puzzle here, the energy mix. Is that the title of the podcast? Energy mix? That's not a very good title. All right. So is it reasonable or is it the future?
Is it
reasonable?
Or is it
the future? Of course, one of the things we need to consider is that with the population decline going down by about, 800,000 people a year, by 2030, how are we going to get the expertise to not only run the existing infrastructure, but implement all of this new infrastructure, next-gen infrastructure? If you say we're just going to import labor from Myanmar and Vietnam, who are just barely holding it together. Myanmar is a failed state. Vietnam is doing all right, but they're not exactly tip top. Are these people going to be now in charge of implementing the hydrogen infrastructure? Do we have the blueprints in place where they can just show up to a job site and fit the pipes together and it's all going to be hunky-dory from there? Not exactly sure. And that also leads into this next business about domestic society. And it's something that I've been wanting to cover for a while, but have not been able to. So let's take a look at the next topic.
Here we go.
Japan's always been very short on natural resources, except water. A lot of Japan's just rife with water, underground water, and it all comes off the mountains and goes into the forests, and the forests, just all this underground water. I've been to Karuizawa, Nikko, I can list a dozen other places off the top of my dome, and just seen how much water is running through the ground in much of Japan. So a friend of mine recently moved up to Mount Fuji area because he loves the natural aquifers up there. And he's saying, this is great. This is amazing. I don't have to worry about water. But a lot of us in the metropolitan areas where most people are being crammed into these days do need to worry about this. This comes to us from the middle of March, but it's something that I found to be very interesting. And it's also tying into the idea, well, we're going to have all of this new technology, the hydrogen, but what about all replacing and maintaining all the existing infrastructure? And that's what this comes to us as. The Mainichi, Japan's national daily since 1922. 75% unaware of government measures on 140-year job to replace Japan's aging water pipes. Poll. There's going to be a picture of an old water pipe if you're interested in looking at that. It's at MatthewPMBigelow.com. Over 3 in 4 respondents in a recent survey on water supply awareness in Japan said that they were unaware of the national and local government's response to the aging of water pipes and delays in efforts to protect the infrastructure against earthquakes. In the poll conducted by Kyoto-based Wacoms, which sells water purifiers, 77.5% of respondents answered that they do not know at all or know little about the status of the national government's response, while 75.8% were similarly unaware of the response taken at the local government level. Most of the water pipelines in Japan were constructed in or after the 1970s, so they're 50 years old now. Think of all those earthquakes. Rattle, rattle. of the around 740,000 kilometers of pipelines, approximately 150,000 kilometers, or roughly 20%, remain in use beyond their legal service life. It's illegal water pipes. Wacom's stresses the need for people to buy their purifiers. No, for people to be aware of the current state of water services. Although there have been a number of accidents caused by aging water pipes throughout Japan, the government estimates that it will take 140 years to replace all the old water pipes. In addition, only about 40% of these pipes are earthquake-proof, and there is a risk that natural disasters and other factors could increase damage to the infrastructure. In fact, the January 1st Noto Peninsula earthquake left many households without water. Why don't you buy their purifiers? The Welfare Ministry estimates that investment in water pipe renewal will be heaviest around 2040. However, when asked to indicate a 10-year time slots from 2030 to 2060, when people think the financial deterioration related to the water supply business will peak, did you know about that? The largest percentage of respondents answered, I don't know, or none of the above. Regarding tap water-related problems they have experienced, seen, or heard about, roughly 30% of the respondents said water outages, and it kind of goes on from there. So I'm just kind of comparing these two things. Well, three things, really. The depopulation of Japan, and the government's recently announced 850,000 migrants over the next 5 years to come in and do a lot of these so-called skilled labor jobs. We'll see what happens if another pandemic hits and all these companies close down, leaving these people to wander aimlessly throughout Japan, which is what happened last time. And also, we're going to have all this next wave gen technology in a Japan society 5.0, all of the AI, that requires top talent. That requires top of the top talent. And that requires all countries right now doing that at the same time. So there's this massive international competitive edge to be at the forefront of AI technologies. So it's not exactly as if there's like these pools of people waiting to be summoned to some AI market. I mean, it's booming right now. So you need the top recruits to go there if you want it to be the best that it can be. So then are we going to have who's going to be replacing all of the hydrogen? Who's going to be installing all of the hydrogen pipes? Then who's going to be fixing all of the water pipes? So there's all of these things going on at the same time, and they're overlapping with each other quite directly. And yet there doesn't really seem to be much of a realistic plan to hold it all together. If there was a workforce that was, or a demographic that was building, it would make sense. But over the next 10, 15, 20 years, the kind of the cards are in. There's going to be fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer and fewer people over the next 20 years. And if it starts coming back, well, it's going to take another 10 to 20 years for those people to enter the job markets and fix those pipes. But I want my pipes to be fixed now, damn it. So that's kind of the idea of looking at certain trends and how they overlap with each other, instead of looking at a headline and going, oh, look, we're going to get the best hydrogen fuel cells and the best hydrogen technology. Oh, look, we're going to have AI now. Oh, look, we're going to have these new water pipes. Really? I wonder what's going to happen with all of that. I wonder. Do you wonder? Do you want
them? Here we go.
Let's wonder. So I was walking around Akasaka Mitsuke in downtown Tokyo a few weeks ago, and I noticed a car go by. And I noticed this car go by because it was outfitted with a raft of sensors, cameras, and driverless technology on it. In my background as, I got to play the Society 5.0 clip.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society.
What?
Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom.
Oh.
Society 5.0. A technology-based, human-centered society.
A human-centered society? What's that? Oh, I think, oh.
The fourth industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example...
All right, so that's the government's 2016-2017 promotional video on YouTube about their Japan Society 5.0, which it just basically means taking it from 1.0, which is farm style, 3.0, 2.0, up the chain, up into this future idea of cloud-based AI, automated, human-centered society. And I worked in the telecommunications industry in Japan here in Tokyo from 2015 to 2020 as an AI researcher and teacher for engineers in the telecom AI space, as well as the executive levels. And so that's how I view this stuff. And since that terminated about 4 years ago, exactly 4 years ago now, I've kept up with it with this podcast. So that kind of, that's my expertise in this thing. 40 hours a week, 5 years, just looking at all the markets, all the research, all over the world. Where is this technology going? And for a while, it was very scary because we kind of wondered, how would you prevent the technology from developing into an AI-style surveillance state that China has implemented, essentially. They have like 700 million facial recognition cameras or AI cameras positioned all over their country. But anyway, so I was, like I said, I was in Nakasaka Mitsuke waiting at an intersection for the light to turn green. And as I was doing so, a car went by equipped with a bevy of surveillance tech on it. Sensors, cameras, LiDAR. If you look at LiDAR, Tesla doesn't use LiDAR. Elon Musk famously said, if you use LiDAR, you will die. I mean, like your company will just go out because the world does not operate as if it's in a LiDAR situation, but the world, driving world, operates as if you are a camera. So the human eyes are the camera looking at the road coming to it. And then you can transfer that into AI computers equipped with cameras for driving tasks and things like that. And they seem to be the leading edge by quite a far pace. So anyway, so this, I looked at the sign on the side of this car that was driving by, and it said Tiger Eye, and it's a Japanese company, which is pretty rare to find. And it says it's a, I'm on the website right now. Let's just do a little preview here. And it says it's a multimodal AI authentication framework for computer vision. And that just means they could do real-time liveness detection, which means preventing falsification of identification, real-time anti-misrecognition. The recognition rate is increased based on detailed information, such as image quality and device information. And they also have Tiger Eye MFA, which is two-step authentication. Yeah, using code and approval function by administrators and so on and so forth. So there are cases that they have an office case for controlling entry on days when the company is closed, such as the weekends, universities, people taking entrance exams and regular tests. So you don't have people coming in with another person's student number to take a test. You would have facial recognition You'd have facial recognition employed to make sure that you don't have fraudulent test takers, apartments for entrance control, delivery drivers, residents, and so on. Temporary visitors can also be employed. And also for hospitals, for like doctors or researchers in restricted areas, they don't need to carry their cards around with them and always scan their cards, which could be a point of failure if somebody steals the card or if they lose the card. If it's just your face and you're a visiting doctor for a few weeks, you put your face in the system, your face gets approved, the door opens, and then you go through. You don't need to worry about your card and things like that. So this is kind of the idea of using computer vision and AI for just admin, essentially. It automates admin. And if you're in a very big office building or a university, all of these are factors that you have to consider. And if you could minimize these risks, then once you get at the scale of a hospital or a university, they have enough money to put this in place. If you have a small apartment building and you're the like a solitary owner of like an apartment building with 20 units in it, you might not want to have this system in place. But if you're a major corporation that has like 30 or 50 apartment complexes throughout a city or a county or a country or a prefecture or something like that, now you're at the level where you might have some sort of security guarantee, and you would use this as part of that to reduce the amount of security officers you would need to hire that can operate things remotely. Of course, it's not going to be perfect for everything, but that's how you can kind of go in. They also have this idea of tiger eye emotion estimation, tiger eye pose estimation, a product based on posture estimation that estimates and utilizes human posture in real time, not really gender estimation. Oh, don't go there. Don't go there, guys. You'll get canceled real soon. So they have, I just thought that was kind of interesting that this is a company that's operating in Japan and looking to employ Japanese use cases. If you've ever listened to this podcast before, what I think is useful about this technology that's on the way and cannot be stopped. I mean, it can't be stopped if everyone just becomes their own, you know, sovereign owner of everything they have. But okay, what about the next 30 or 40 years of people? I mean, the boomers that have this idea of privacy, that's going to be a dying thing. Some people will still have it, but there's other people like me that believe you could possibly have a little bit of both. What I like about this technology is that it's limited to a specific area. It's not the Chinese style panopticon that follows you around the street, follows you around the city like a schizophrenic nightmare where you try to convince like, hey, the traffic lights are looking at me, mom, and the government is analyzing the way I walk and storing it in a database in the cloud. It's like, well, you need your meds and you need them now. But in China, that's the truth all of the time now. But what about this stuff is that it's for a apartment building. It's for a hospital in a certain zone. So it has a cutoff point. So you know when you're getting into it and you know when you're leaving it. And that's, for me, the key point here for this technology is that we know when it's in place, when it's in use, what it's being used for, and we can leave it behind at the end of the day, and that it's not going to be used to tally some sort of social credit score, some sort of point. It's not going to be used for like board security or police officers to follow us around on the streets because we have a bag on our arm that they might be interested in buying or something like that, some sort of human failure point. So this company is called Tiger Eye. I'll be posting links to it at MatthewPMBigelow.com. Let's see about their partners. What's their partners? About their partners. The partner list. Wired Packages, Nippon Dix. That's the Morinaga Plaza main building. Oh, that's a big one. NetEar Group. Don't know what that is, but it's in Ginza. And ITC Japan Co. Limited. Again, that seems to be a tech company. So it looks like they're just starting up. They don't really have the biggest landmark here. Footprint in the market, but maybe they're on their way up. I don't know. They could fail tomorrow for all I know. So that's Tiger Eye Solution. Next, we're going to take a look at, we got a lot today. In another area that we're just take a brief look at here, it's not really the news. Sometimes just reading the news all day, I don't know, it's like it bogs me down, and sometimes the details aren't that pertinent. But this comes to us from driverless cars to smart homes inside Japan's futuristic Woven City by Toyota. Toyota opened up Woven City probably about 5-6 years ago now, and it's basically part of a Toyota like land holdings. You could imagine a company like Toyota. It's like over 10% of Japan's GDP. They have a huge amount of land, and as miniaturization occurs and as parts and the company becomes streamlined, you end up having a whole bunch of land that used to be used for something that maybe isn't used for anything right now. So they're taking some of that, they've taken some of that land and they've applied it to an idea of an R&D facility to see how this connected future that a lot of these giant corporations view could be put into place. Woven City, Japan's futuristic metropolis conceptualized by Toyota. One of the highlights of Woven City is its fleet of driverless or self-driving cars known as e-pallets. I believe that's in combination with SoftBank, actually, under the Monet subsidiary, meaning mobile network, serving as a testing ground for Toyota's renewable energy experiments. These futuristic vehicles will navigate dedicated lanes separate from pedestrian and cyclist paths. That's a key point. For this technology, you can't just have the horses and the sports cars occupying the same lanes. The same thing goes for this. I've seen videos of San Francisco with Google's Waymo or other self-driving cars, and citizens will just start throwing pylons on them and putting pylons around them. The cars don't know what to do. They shut down. They start blocking traffic, and then the police come, and I think I saw one. Like, there was an unoccupied driverless car in the middle of a road, and some officer, police officer in San Francisco, starts walking up to it with its gun, with his gun drawn, like, "Stop right now, what are you doing?" But he's talking to a car. That's dystopia right there. You need to separate these things. And said Tokyo intends to leverage data from these cars to understand local traffic. They also want to use hydrogen-based technology and smart homes with sensors in the smart homes. It's a little bit much, but I think they're just trying to throw everything at the wall and seeing what sticks. Combining traditional Japanese architecture with modern amenities, the city's construction will employ robotic techniques designed specifically for this purpose. Initially housing 360 residents, primarily Toyota employees, Woven City plans to expand to accommodate up to 2,000 individuals. Now, that would be a job perk I would love to have, to move your family into an experimental 15-minute city, to be monitored at all times by your boss. So you're working at Toyota, you go home to Toyota, Toyota's in your house, Toyota's in your streets, Toyota's in your family, everything is just Toyota. That's what they mean by Woven City. And they also have an idea for drone delivery, but we'll see where that comes from. An idea I had coming to the studio today was the reason to cover and expand topics outside of tech for this type of podcast is that prior to COVID, which shut everything down, a lot of this drone technology was being aimed at the delivery service sectors. It never really took off. But then COVID kind of should have promoted it in a way, but for some reason it got even more stymied. And then when the Russians took part of QU, the Donbass area in Ukraine, that's when we really saw the drone technology kick into high gear. So if we were more aware of how it could be applied in war or what it would be like in the future, we might have had more civilian use cases by now. But because it was swept up into areas that were not really predicted, it's gone now. It's everybody's just investing in weaponized drones now. That's where they are. They're weapons now. Would you like one? That'd be kind of neat, actually, to chase some dude around in your house with a drone with a gun on it. What are you doing here? Oh, don't shoot me. Boom. Then another drone comes out and cleans the brains off the floor, sells it to a medical company specializing in AI from brain damage, gun victims, and then you get some money in return. That's the security state I want. And it probably wouldn't be Toyota. It would be like a Toyota subsidiary that would do such a thing called Brain Oda. Yeah, that's what it is. We got a couple of other things. I said that stuff about the drone, but I'm being hypocritical in a way because Japan Airlines starts drone service in remote areas for disasters. Disaster use case is actually pretty easy to point out because you can easily get people to agree with it. If you have your grandmother trapped underneath some rubble, some remote location after an earthquake, you're going to be like, "Grandma, we're going to sacrifice your security and your privacy for some life-saving technology, potentially." Japan Airlines has kicked off an unmanned drone service. I will say this, though, before we begin. This is actually what always happens. We're supposed to get drone services everywhere, okay? They're going to be in this tiny little area. but they kind of get nerfed along the regulatory pathway, especially nowadays where every agency has like 50 billion, massive swath of divisions that really exist to just kind of nerf ideas and nerf systems where it's supposed to be something amazing, like getting fried chicken and highballs delivered to you from a robot in a park, like on legs or on wheels, and you order it remotely. And then what it ends up being is like peanuts and water that you order on your phone, and then you go to a dispensary and it's there and it's available at one park for 1 week only. And then they plan to use that data for future events and things like that. So quite frequently what happens is that the administrative state nerfs all of the great ideas that we could have and replaces it with just pain in the ass products that nobody ever really wants. Japan Airlines has kicked off an unmanned drone service to deliver goods and medical supplies in a remote part of Japan that's prone to heavy rains and landslides. The carrier is working with local authorities in the town of Setouchi, a tiny inlet in Okayama Prefecture that's home to 8,000 residents. See? 8,000 residents. A Phaser RG2 drone will be deployed by Amami Island Drones for the work, JAL said Thursday. People living in the area normally rely on ships for their daily logistic needs, but these vessels are often stranded by rough waves and have to cancel their scheduled runs. The average age of residents in Setouchi is 53. While JAL has been conducting various drone experiments at different locations, this is the first commercial service for disaster relief and prescient for a nation that's prone to weather-related catastrophes. Quote, there used to be a lag in grasping the situation when a natural calamity hit the town, but with this service, local authorities will know sooner, a JAL spokesperson. How will they know? I don't know. It doesn't say anything about that. Similar initiatives are underway elsewhere in Asia. Cross-border drone delivery services between Malaysia and Singapore, see, that sounds a lot more dynamic, doesn't it? May start for critical deliveries such as medical supplies and perishable food. Amami Island Drones was established by JAL in Setouchi Town in 2023. Initial trials of the service started in 2020, and so on. So, like I said, yeah, it looks like it's happening, but is it, you know, is it? A couple of more ideas on drone warfare. Japan, Australia to conduct study on underwater drones. Not going to go too much into that, but underwater drones. Now, there is an area because it's not, people won't hear it. People won't see it. So people won't complain about it. They can't fall on your head as they're delivering pizza to your neighbor or drone delivery services at night or something like that, where you might have people complaining about noise and things like that. Go underwater and see if they can blow things up. It's better than World War II when Japan put kids in their torpedoes and aimed them at the Allies. Japan's defense ministry looks into photonics for drone warfare as well. So like I said, we're looking at drones being more and more used openly and widely in warfare situations. Local governments supporting elderly by promoting cashless payment systems. Not sure how that's going to come up. And let's take a look at these. I might do this next one for the next podcast, but let's finish Japan Society 5.0 with this one. It's just a couple of paragraphs. It's behind a paywall, but it says Japan and ASEAN to launch joint QR code payment service in fiscal year 2025. International travelers expect to benefit from the initiative. Coming to us from the Nikkei staff writer, this is from the Nikkei English site, which is a globalist PSYOP publication. The editors from this place said, Joe Biden gave the best speech ever. It's like, you can hate Trump. And you can like Biden, but you can't say he gave a great speech when he mumbles and shouts, okay? You can't do that. That's not journalism. That's advocacy, you nimnods. The Japanese government has started talks with Southeast Asian countries. Again, this is started talks. So again, it's this thing where this is what happens. Technology is here, and the government wants to use this amazing technology. So we're starting talks. Well, where does this lead to? So it appears as if it's here, but it's not here. They're just talking about it. They're talking to each other to have meetings about the meetings. And then by the end of it, what's it's going to be? You're going to be able to buy peanuts from Chiba by going to Chiba and registering your QR code in advance and having, you have to bring a picture of yourself and they'll put it into a computer and then have that computer scan your face to confirm your ID. And then you'll be able to get some peanuts via a point system that you will have registered in advance prior to coming to Japan. And then that will be deducted from your credit card point system, but that will be reimbursed by a secondary system. So then you'll get your peanuts and it won't really end up costing you anything. That's generally what happens with this technology. The initiative will make QR code systems compatible with each other by fiscal 2025, which begins in April of that year, allowing cashless payments in different countries without having to change money. Japan's Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry has already held discussions with Southeast Asian governments and central banks in countries such as Indonesia and Cambodia, according to a government official. The Payments Japan Association, which operates the country's standardized QR code payment system called JPQR, will build a new system as early as this year, aiming to connect it to overseas service providers. Anything else? Japan's move towards interoperability with other QR code payment systems aims to strengthen its ties with the region in terms of economic security and data use, blah, blah, blah. I wonder if SoftBank will be involved with that because they have this system. I can't remember the name of it. The SoftBank QR code payment system. SoftBank QR code payment. Oh, that's just going to give me PayPay. It's not PayPay. It's another one. It's not. It's just going to give me PayPay. All right. And anything else for today? Let's look at the local governments supporting elderly by promoting cashless payment services. Nah, let's not. Let's not at all. We'll take a look at some more AI services on the next podcast for the Japan What podcast. So that's going to be Society 5.0 for today. Again, that Tiger Eye, very interesting, isn't it? When you think about the services that Tiger Eye is aiming to install and enable and provide to people, whereas the government, which is with its official Japan Society 5.0 labeling, it's like we want to have QR code payment systems between Cambodia and Japan, and we're going to think about it next year. It's like, well, okay. Is that going to be a big thing? Whereas Tiger Eye is going out and busting their ass and already providing services to have streamlining facilities so that people waste less time and have fewer security problematic points in their systems. So those are the two main contrasting aspects of Japan Society 5.0. The officials in charge lollygag in their asses because that's all they know how to do. And then people in the private industry who are, kicking ass and taking names. So good luck, Tiger. Maybe I'll try to get you on the podcast sometime. I wonder what you'd have to say.
The fourth industrial revolution will enable us to create a new society. Artificial intelligence will transform the big data collected through the Internet of Things into new wisdom. Society 5.0, a technology-based, human-centered society. The fourth industrial revolution will raise our standard of living and solve various challenges we face. It will, for example, free us from the stress of driving, allowing us to safely visit anyone, anytime. We will have access to the latest medical advancements at a low cost, no matter where we are. AI and robots will enhance.
Let's do some war.
Die for the war, never more than more. Die for the good, for the good. Die for the war, die for the war.
There's two aspects to the war segment on the Japan What podcast. We'll get to that in a second. Why not go to MatthewPMBigelow.com and make a donation? You've thought about it before. We need your money. We need some money to keep the lights on here. You can do that by going through PayPal at paypal.me/JapanWUT. That's paypal.me/JapanWUT. We're also part of the Podcasting 2.0 infrastructure. Get rid of that legacy app you have for your podcast. Spotify ain't doing nothing for you. Go to Podverse, go to Fountain, go to podcastapps.com and get a Podcasting 2.0 compliant app. And recently as well, Podbean, a major supplier of podcasts, is on board. This allows listeners to donate Satoshis, which are Bitcoin micropayments, directly to the podcaster via the app. There's no intermediary sources. There's no way to scam. There's no Sam Bankman-Fried in the way. It's open source protocol. It's like giving your money to a donut shop for a donut. So do that right now. Give us a boost. Send us some sats. We need the money. Or you can go to MatthewPMBigelow.com at the very least and send us some traffic. Click on the links a little bit and look at all of the photos and sources that we are putting up there for you to study in addition to what's being reported on the podcast for this episode. All links are posted there. We appreciate you. We appreciate your donations. And thank you very much. Now back to the war. So there's the idea of a physical war, which is the idea that China and Taiwan will have this conflict. And China is really pushing the Philippines right now, water cannons on their ships. And like, these are very far away from China's southern shores of Hainan, like 1,000 kilometers away, going around trying to establish more military outposts in the South China Sea so that China can basically commandeer supply chain routes and things like that. But with the way that the pieces are falling, the way that the forecasting bones are being tossed on the table from the cup of the shaman, the United States and Japan and South Korea are kind of on one side with Taiwan and the Philippines, and on the other side is North Korea, Russia, China, Iran, and then goes on from there. But when we think about North Korea, one aspect of North Korea is that they're a very militaristic society, or they proclaim themselves to be. And if China attacks the island of Taiwan, what could happen then is North Korea and Russia could have some diversions or frustration tactics going on in the Korean Peninsula and above the Korean Peninsula via Russia to sort of suck up resources from South Korea and Japan so that they don't en masse go to defend Taiwan and help the Philippines should hit the Anfei. And another aspect, we'll just say that there was recently, we're going to focus on North Korea right now, just for today. Kim Jong-un lauds tank unit's history of invading Seoul in headquarters visit. So recently, Kim Jong-un's really been pushing military boom, boom, selling more products to Russia, it seems. And Russia is breaking the sanctions imposed onto North Korea. Probably a good thing, by the way, with the amount of starvation going on there. I don't know. They need some money. They need something. I'm not supporting North Korea, but having it entirely isolated with what they're doing to their people over there ain't so hot. But one thing that is often forgotten about, and that's what I like to harp on about, is the diaspora of North Koreans situated around where the Empire of Japan used to be situated. So the Korean Peninsula up until the end of World War II was part of Japan. They had soldiers, Japanese soldiers, Korean soldiers were Japanese soldiers in World War II. And a lot of them got left behind in Sakhalin, an island north of Hokkaido, but a lot of them got also left behind within Japan. They were used as laborers. I'm not really familiar. I'm pretty sure they weren't treated as like the best thing ever, but they're here. So there's this massive diaspora of North Koreans inside of Japan, and they live in Japan and they operate in Japan as North Koreans. They're not Japanese citizens. They are technically North Koreans, but they're a state that Japan does not recognize. We say in English, North Korea and South Korea, but in Japanese, North Korea is regarded as Kita Chosen, and Korea, South Korea, is regarded as Kankoku. So they have different names for them, completely different names. Chosen is the traditional name for like the empire there. And they are also in, like I said, in Japan. And this comes to us from, let's just open this up, from NorthKoreaNews.org, actually, which is something that I like to follow. And my whole thing is if you have generations of North Koreans trained in Japan, like literally, like they grow up in Japan as North Koreans, but they can probably fit in pretty easily, then you have this internal threat as well, where if war breaks out with Taiwan, and if North Korea is more and more aligned with Russia and China, well, they might be able to use the North Korean diaspora in Japan as a further distraction or as a disruption effort to waste Japanese resources and prevent them from using a full-scale support of America in the Taiwan Straits and the Philippines and so on. So anyways, this comes to us from North Korea News, and this says, North Korean IT workers impersonating Japanese nationals to secure jobs. Tokyo. Japan advisory echoes warning that the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK, overseas laborers are earning millions to fund Pyongyang's nuclear ambitions. Japan has received, when does this come to us from? March 26th, 2024. Japan has issued an advisory that North Korean IT workers are impersonating Japanese nationals to secure jobs, underscoring the role of these skilled professionals in funding Pyongyang's nuclear and missile development. By adopting Japanese identities, North Korea's overseas IT professionals allegedly secured jobs with Japanese companies through an unmanned online platform, Tokyo's Foreign Ministry, Finance Ministry, Economy Ministry, and the National Police Agency said in a joint alert earlier. These IT workers typically use false ID, to conceal their identities and nationality, but some register their accounts by using relatives or acquaintances in Japan as proxies and offering them a commission. The advisory also warned that North Korean IT workers may be involved in Pyongyang's other malicious cyber activities. The alert reaffirmed concerns raised by the UN panel of experts monitoring DPRK sanctions violations. Citing experts' estimates, the panel reported last year that as many as 10,000 North Korean IT professionals were still operating out of other countries, and the latest report estimated that these skilled workers acquire between $250 million and $600 million every year. The U.S. and South Korea have issued advisories similar to Japan's in recent years, but alongside these warnings, Washington has cracked down on North Korea's illicit fundraising. Often based out of China, Russia, and Southeast Asia, these IT professionals receive payment, according to the Japanese alert. The use of VPNs and remote desktops apparently really helps them to conduct such activities. I'm paraphrasing a little bit here. To avoid hiring North Korean IT workers inadvertently, the alert advised Japanese companies to watch out for telltale signs, such as lack of fluency in Japanese, unwillingness to communicate through video conferencing, attempts to take on work outside the online recruitment platform, and promising lower costs than market rates. Huh. Yeah, that's interesting. It must be a real naive sense amongst Japanese nationals who aren't familiar with this. So anyways, I just thought that was interesting. I hadn't really thought about the North Koreans getting into the IT industry within Japan to, the sleeper cells potentially there in case war breaks out in the next few years. They could really do some damage, if they're allowed into certain areas of the company that house data networks or secure cables and things like that. They could really stir up some shit if they wanted to. Maybe they just want some money and don't mind having a normal life. But people committed to ideologies do pretty crazy things, which is what we're witnessing a lot in America right now, if you haven't noticed at all. All right. So anyways, so that's going to be an extra fold in the interesting aspects of pre-war, the North Korean IT professionals working in Japan. So thank you. That's the war segment.
War! Everybody moves. Die for the good, for the good. Die for the war. Die for the war.
And that's going to be today's podcast. So thank you for listening to the Japan What Podcast, episode 144. Coming at you from the armpit of Asia, I bid thee a warmful and heartful ja mata.